Chapter 14. The Quest. Sorrows to Spare. The Mountain. How long had it been? The Horologs had been the first system to fail. Amon no longer knew how long he had followed his father's trail across the planet of the sorcerers. Years, if the wheezing of his armor's servos and the rust eating its plates was any guide. Or had he only recently set out from the ruins of the Obsidian Tower? Time moved strangely within the great ocean, and many were the tales of travelers undone by its temporal chaos. Some flew its tides for a day, only to return and find the empires they once knew had gone to dust. Others emerged centuries before their birth, strangers in lands once familiar. Dust-stiffened rags swayed the remains of Amon's armor, fluttering in frozen winds as he left the ruins of Nofke's crystalline cathedral behind. Magnus had passed this way, lost and alone. And where the Crimson King trod, miracles followed. Everywhere Magnus worked his wonders, the etheric winds carried rumor of them to those with the wit to hear it. Amon had followed every such rumor, tormented by the pain of his ruined body and the guilt of knowing his father had fallen to madness because of him. In his seemingly endless quest, Amon had seen great and terrible things, witnessed the sins of the past and the future's many dooms. He saw ghosts of heroism unmatched and suffered the echoes of deeds too terrible to imagine. He fought countless battles, defeated hosts of monsters, but remained always two steps behind the Crimson King. In his darker moments, Amon almost believed his father did not want to be found. Every time such disloyal thoughts rose from the abyssal depths of his mind, despair took him until some fresh rumor lured him onwards with the promise of finally locating the Primarch. Such a rumor had muttered of Nopf-Ke, a minor Pavoni known to possess only limited grasp of his fellowship's artes. The ether winds whispered of how he had raised tens of thousands of ancient crystal corpses to craft a titanic ossuary of gleaming glass. They spoke of him waging war against his Prosperine brothers with an invincible army of Hetis, wrought from ice and breath. Trying not to let hope blind him to the likely falsehood of this latest rumour, Amon bade his Stormbird follow the muttering winds to its source. Like him, the gunship had changed greatly in these strange times, its silhouette slowly assuming a more hawk-like aspect, its mien transforming from screaming raptor to patient hunter. As soon as he had laid eyes upon the crystalline ossuary, Amon recognized his father's ethercraft. The Crimson King's power bled from every reflection and star-bright pinpoint of light. Nopf-Ke barred its gates against him, so Amon summoned his awesome power and proceeded to demolish the crystal ossuary piece by piece. A thousands-strong host of ice-born Hetis sallied forth from the splintering fortress, but they were crudely made things and insultingly easy to destroy. The will animating them was weak, and Amon easily unraveled the raptures that gave them life. He had marched through the dissipating host, limping towards a tower of purest sapphire. Nopf-Ke tried to fight, but against an adept of Amon's skill and cunning, it was a gesture of defiance, nothing more. With Amon's ritual dagger at his throat, Nopf-Ke's valediction had been to speak of encountering a red-robed magus, whose face was hidden behind a shimmering veil. The magus bore a silver key on a broken chain, and his power was clearly immense, but he knew neither his name nor from whence he had come. Nopf-Ke wept as he told Amon how he had spun lies of brotherhood to keep the nameless magus at his side long enough to learn the secrets of his power. "You are a blind fool, and you learn nothing," Amon had told Nopf-Ke, plunging the dagger deep into the meat of the Pavoni's throat. "You stood at the side of a god, and still I unmade your raptures in the blink of an eye."
"Who was he?"
Nopf-Ke begged of him, each word drawing a fresh squirt of blood around the blade twisting in his neck.
"I must know."
"He who is father to us all," said Amon.
"No,"
cried Knopf K, coughing a frothed wad of gloss-red sputum.
I am his son. I would have known him.
He does not even know himself, said Ammon, gripping the hilt of the Athane tighter. And you are no son of Magnus.
Wait,
begged Knopf K.
He is still here.
Where? Demanded Ammon, easing pressure on the blade.
He went deeper into the vale,
said Knopf K, bending his dismal artes to halting the tide of blood pouring from his neck.
Following the River of Stars.
Ammon did not give Knopf K a chance to undo the damage, and sawed his blade down hard, cutting his neck open to the bone. He left the corpse for the many-eyed worms already wriggling from the earth, and the manta creatures circling overhead. Knopf K had been a worthless adept in life, but his corpse was saturated in etheric energy, and such meat was a rarity. Beyond the shattered ossuary, Ammon followed the vale's twisting path, plunging ever deeper into an icy labyrinth of moaning glaciers and frozen gorges that echoed to wendigo howls. He tasted the raw energy of the great ocean, flowing from the secret heart of the mountains in an invisible river. It glittered behind his eyes, and he well understood why Magnus might seek to follow it to the source. He limped painfully into the soaring peaks without pause, travelling for what felt like many days. He climbed beyond the clouds until the pain in his spine became so great he could only crawl on bloodied palms and aching bones. He kept going until he could go no farther. And just as he contemplated turning back, he arrived at a frozen plateau of liminal space, where the barriers between worlds was whisper-thin. Its glassy surface was littered with toppled megaliths and carved with colossal geometric designs, like those of the ancient Nazcans, dead men who unwisely sought to draw the eye of the gods upon them. A river that glittered with the light of stars foamed up from the ruins of what had once been a vast palace that looked hauntingly familiar. The impossible passage of non-time had transformed it to little more than crumbling outlines of its once great halls and mighty colonnades. The river flowed along the geometric channels, here fast-flowing, there meandering languidly, sometimes pooling in small lakes or rushing in torrents around broken stonework. Could Magnus be here? Ammon climbed painfully to his feet, letting the potency of the air fill his lungs. He limped over the plateau, feeling as though each bend in the path might carry him somewhere new, somewhere beyond his comprehension. Ghosts of other worlds hovered tantalizingly at the edge of sight, a million vistas of times and places unknown. A single misstep might carry him beyond anything he had ever experienced. Who was to say he had not already made that step?
"I seek Magnus the Red!"
he shouted, and the echoes slipped into the cracks between worlds. Who knew to where they might travel, or who might hear them, and what they might do with them? Entire religions had been built on far less, and the thought of what he might be causing with careless words in so powerful a place kept him silent. Instead, he focused on his feet, watching them rise and fall, his left twisted, his right sure and firm. He saw his reflection in the ice. Decades spent in search of his father had left him a gaunt revenant of the warrior he had been, hollowed out and all but hopeless. Decades? More like centuries. A thin wailing sound drifted on the wind. A lamentation? Ammon looked up to see a group of pallbearers emerge from the ruined palace. Hooded in dust-shawled mourning robes of crimson, they bore a great bier of shields upon their shoulders, seven to each side, and one leading their grief-stricken passage. They followed the course of the river, their leader reading aloud from an enormous book that drifted in the air before him, the pages turning of their own volition. Guilt followed in a pall of ether ghosts, and as Ammon struggled onwards, the agony of his injuries surged with fresh spite. The mourners stopped at a churning bend in the river, where it foamed with veiled mists. Other lands and other times shimmered in the spume, bright places that knew neither war nor suffering. As he drew nearer, Amon saw the body borne upon the shields was that of a legionary, his armour crimson and ivory. His helm sat on his chest, nestled between his crossed arms.
"Utissa," said Amon.
The pallbearers looked up, and beneath their hoods Amon saw each wore a variation on the face of the Crimson King. Some were sallow-skinned, others wounded. Some were tattooed, some were branded, but all had their eyes gouged from their sockets as punishment for this murder. They turned their blind faces towards him as Amon reached their leader and pulled back his hood. The breath caught in Amon's throat. The Crimson King stared back at him. Not an aspect or a shard, but the Primarch himself. Yet Amon saw no acknowledgement in his father's eyes, only horror. The Primarch's hair was wild and matted like that of a savage, his skin sapped of all vitality by loss. He alone of these aspects retained his eye, and he fixed it upon Amon with such venom that it took the equerry's breath away.
"Father,"
he began.
"You,"
snapped Magnus, jabbing him in the chest.
"A knight of Magnus! You, who thought yourselves gods! You, who promised enlightenment but brought only death and darkness! What arrogance! What hubris! How dare you put yourselves above all others!"
"No," said Amon. "That is not what
I failed,"
said Magnus, his anger replaced with soul-deep weariness.
"I reached too far, and did not heed the warnings of those who knew better. I doomed us all."
"My lord," cried Amon, as the mourners lifted the bier of shields from their shoulders, ready to let the body of Balak Utizar slide into the river.
"I am no lord,"
said Magnus, sinking to his knees at the water's edge.
"I think perhaps I was once a man of worth, but now I am nothing."
"No," cried Amon, kneeling beside his father.
"You are Magnus the Red, Primarch of the Thousand Suns. You are the Crimson King, wisest of us all, and we need you more than ever. Come back to us, please."
Magnus looked him in the eye, and for a fraction of a second it was as if his father stared back at him.
"He is gone," said Magnus. "We will all be gone soon, and the universe will be well rid of us."
The mourners released the bier, and it carried Utisar's body into the river. The water claimed its prize, and Amon watched as swirling tides drew it down to unknown depths.
"I killed him," said Magnus, "just as I killed all my sons."
"No," said Amon, "only you can save them."
"Once, maybe," said Magnus. "That task now falls to another."
"Ahriman?" Magnus stood, but did not answer as the mourners moved to surround Amon. He saw his doom writ upon their sightless faces and tried to stand, but Magnus held him with firm hands upon his shoulders.
"It is better for us to pass swiftly from this world," said Magnus, "to slip into oblivion before we wreak more harm upon those we love. It is time for us to die."
The dust-caked mourners closed in around Amon, taking hold of his arms and neck. He struggled against them, searching for his powers, but finding only a howling void of emptiness.
"Please, father,"
he yelled,
"come back to us."
And suddenly the river was rushing up to meet him. It felt like crashing through a wall of ice. The frozen water hit him like a blow, paralyzing his limbs and locking him with a cold that shock-froze his lungs. The currents spun him around, eager to toy with their new plaything. Grasping hands clutched him from below, dragging him down to join the dead. Amon looked up through the swirling chaos of bubbles and saw his father looking back at him. And then he saw nothing at all. Olgir Widdowson came for Lemuel in the darkest part of the Doramar's night watch and told him he had to come now. The wolf did not apologize for the lateness of the hour, but Lemuel had been awake anyway. Sleep did not come easily to Lemuel, and when it did, it brought nightmares of Committee Sona. He dreamed of eyeless things, of tortures and lost friends. But most of all, he dreamed of a young boy whose name he could not remember. A boy who would never grow old, never know love, and never ever let Lemuel forget he was a murderer. Rubbing his eyes, he awkwardly pulled on a pair of stained fatigues and followed Widdowson. From the crew decks down into the engineering spaces, below the waterline and past the reeking bilges, through forgotten underdeck transits and dripping conduits stagnant with bad oil, stale air, and the incongruous smell of livestock. In moments, he was entirely lost, with no idea where they were in the ship. Widdowson responded to none of Lemuel's questions and divulged nothing of their destination, save to say it was time for him to earn his keep. In the weeks since his session with Lady Valeda, Lemuel had seen no one other than the warriors of the Sixth Legion. No matter how many times he asked to see Chaya or Yasu Nagasena, his requests were met with stony silence or curt refusals. In that time, however, he was visited by each of the Space Wolves in turn. They came whenever it suited them. It made no difference to them whether he was eating or washing, fitfully sleeping or awake. If they wanted to talk, he was bound to listen. Each warrior would sit across from him and speak of the brother they had lost on Committee Sona. Sometimes these recollections were anecdotes that barely mentioned Har Balagir at all. Others were epic recountings of a campaign, complete with every detail from the weather to the circumstances that had brought the rout, a term Lemuel quickly came to realize was one of the wolves' names for themselves, to war. Some spoke of Balagir's strengths, others his weaknesses. They told Lemuel of his trials on Fenris, his tribal customs, his favoured fighting styles, his physical prowess, and his utter lack of humour. It seemed, at times, that each wolf was describing a different man. When he'd pointed that out to Svavnir Rakwulf, the last of the wolves to visit him, the warrior shrugged and said, "Isn't that true of everyone? We all were shaped by how others see us, as much as our own character." He'd felt irritated by these interruptions, but quickly came to realize this was as close as legionaries came to showing grief before mortals. When the need to unburden themselves came upon them, his concerns were the least of theirs. Finally, Widdowson came to an archway, misted with a fine drizzle of moisture at the end of a radial conduit. He ducked underneath, water spattering from the plates of his armor and soaking the pelt at his shoulder. The darkness beyond swallowed the wolf, leaving Lemuel alone in the half-light of the echoing conduit. He heard sounds from within, grunts and scrapes of blades being sharpened. Smoke from an open fire leavened the metallic dampness of the air. Lemuel took a deep breath and tasted death. He had been waiting for this moment ever since the Space Wolves had boarded the Cypria Selene and taken them prisoner. Lemuel risked a glance over his shoulder, knowing he would be overtaken and killed if he tried to flee.
"Once more into the breach," he said, and closed his eyes.
Lemuel stepped into the dripping arch, sensing this was more than a physical threshold he was crossing. Through on the other side, he spat a mouthful of chemical-tasting water and blinked. He wiped moisture from his face with his remaining hand, smelling a pungent animal reek of wet fur, raw meat, and smoke. Low registers of breath from all around him triggered a prey response. Sweat prickled his forehead. The scale of the chamber was impossible to guess, but it felt large. Lemuel pictured a great hall, with hand-carved wooden posts supporting blackened beams and a timbered ceiling of thatch from which hung vast tusks and other trophies won from the ocean. Heat assailed him from a low-banked fire that smouldered in a pit with a deep cherry-red glow. Its illumination was fitful, hinting at shapes just beyond its reach.
"You are Lemuel Gaumon of Sanga, seventh-born son of Vekesa and Ekua," said a voice he recognized as Biaki's.
"Here I am," he said.
The darkness rippled in front of him, and suddenly the rune priest was there, towering over him, vast and primal in his pelt-draped armor and wolf-skull headpiece. His eyes glimmered yellow in the gloom. He held a carved drinking horn in one hand, filled with a viscous, acrid-smelling liquid.
You know why we bring you to our eight?
Not really,
confessed Lemuel.
I thought maybe you were going to kill me, but now I'm not so sure.
Biaki grinned, exposing teeth that seemed a lot sharper and more dangerous than before.
I want to kill you, said Biaki, revealing a bone-handled knife, limed in bluish frost, on his other hand. But that is not your weird.
You should kill me,
wept Lemuel, as guilt welled up from within him.
Throne, I killed him. I made his mother kill him. It's more than I deserve to be knifed in the dark.
True, said Biaki. But that murder was only your first.
What? No,
said Lemuel.
I see a time when you will be a new man with a new name, one that strikes terror in those who hear it. You will be the death of worlds.
Lemuel shook his head.
No, I could never.
It is your weird, said Biaki with a fatalistic shrug, as he drew the blade across his palm and let the blood run down his hand. But that is not why you are here.
Then why am I here?
You are a remembrancer, yes, said Biaki,
reaching up to smear his red fingertips down Lemuel's tear-streaked face.
I was,
said Lemuel, biting his lip at the caustic smell and oily texture of the rune priest's blood, dimly aware of sinuous movement in the shadows.
Then remember, said Biaki, backing towards the fire.
Remember what?
All you have been told, said Biaki,
taking a long draught from the drinking horn before tipping the rest over the fire. It roared to life as though doused with promethium, and billowing yellow flames reached to the vaulted roof. Lemuel shielded his eyes against the furious glare, but in that brief moment of illumination, he saw he was surrounded.
Har Balagir was my brother,
said Olgir Widowson, standing a handspan to his left.
Dishonor his memory, and I will tear your head from your shoulders. Har Balagir was my brother, said Svafnir Rakwulf on his right. Speak ill of his legacy, and I will eat your heart. Har Balagir was my brother, said Gyrlothnir Hellblind. Misspeak his deeds, and
you'll rip out my spine, said Lemuel. I welcome it.
I was going to crush your skull, but I like yours better, said Hellblind with a grin that wasn't at all reassuring. Let the sending away begin, said Biaki.
Each of the wolves stepped back, and Lemuel saw why he had been brought here, why the wolves had brought him their accounts. It hadn't been to unburden themselves of grief, and he'd been foolish to ascribe so mortal a motive to these transhuman warriors. The armored body of Har Balagir sat at the far end of the chamber on a high-backed wooden throne. A savage king of battle, mantled in furs and girded for war in frost-gray plate. His war-notched sword lay across his thighs, and despite the cut line across his forehead and the stitching sealing his eyes shut, Lemuel had the strongest sensation he might spring into action at a moment's notice. Lemuel closed his eyes and took a long, deep breath. He began to speak, retelling the tales he had been told, leaving nothing out and giving each warrior's account of his brother its due time in the light. He spoke until his throat was in rasping agony, until the sending away was done. It took 12 hours. With the last tale told, he sank to his knees at the dying fire's embers and looked up to see if he had satisfied his audience or whether they would make good on their threats. But the chamber was empty. 7 islands of coalesced matter adrift in the great ocean, each linked to the other by arcing webs of lightning. The largest was a vast continental plate, an ashen wasteland with magma rivers and dust-choked ruins of such monumental scale they must once have been inhabited by giants. The smallest was a lightless mansion, ripped from its earthly foundations and cast without heed into the tides of the warp. Others were mountain ranges of fire that extended from the base of rippling lakes of warp forms. Some appeared to be living creatures, colossal entities whose scale and appearance defied any classification of form. The rest reshaped themselves from moment to moment, the roiling anarchy of their appearance impossible to pin down for more than an instant.
"The Seven Sleepers,"
said Aphogomon, standing before the oculus like a grotesque ringmaster unveiling the latest additions to his freak show.
"Just as I promised."
Ahriman fought to hold his temper in check, something that had become ever more challenging on the ether-nulled Osiris Panthea. Just being aboard the black ship chafed his every nerve and turned any brotherly utterance into a mortal insult. Tolbeck and Caillou had already come to blows, and many others were on the verge of violence. Every starfarer knew each ship had a unique aspect, a character all its own. Some vessels were vainglorious, others steadfast, or imbued with reckless aggression to match their past captains. But the Osiris Panthea carried shame at its heart. In another age, it would have been designated a Guineaman, a slave ship bearing unwilling souls into unending servitude in foreign lands. The nature of the cargo might have changed. Psykers doomed to an agonizing fate in the name of the Imperium, instead of laborers worked to death in its countless manufactories, but the end result was the same. The Osiris Panthea knew it had been crafted for an ignoble purpose, and centuries of anguished guilt saturated its bones. Its every system was truculent and morbidly resistant, especially to those touched by the power of the great ocean. Muttering voices lingered in its empty transitways, and half-glimpsed phantoms spied from the shadows of every deck. Such things should have been impossible on a vessel so heavily warded, but every man in their reduced company knew better. Ahriman had sensed ghosts at his shoulder ever since they'd escaped Committee Sona. He felt the silent accusations of those he'd sought to save from the flesh change as they died in his fire. Worse, their numbers were legion, far more than had ever gone to ash and dust in his tower. He tried not to think what that might mean, and for once was glad his Corvidae seer sight was in decline.
"Ignis," said Ahriman.
"There are no auspicious numbers here,"
replied the Master of Ruin, without looking up from his post, his brow vexed.
"I can find no Euclidean angles and no vectors cohering. The order of this place will not hold."
"So what you were saying,"
offered Sanact, polishing his jackal-bladed sword with grim intensity,
"is that you have no idea what these are." "Are they safe?"
said Ahriman.
"We can venture down there."
"Go down there,"
said Tolbeck, gauntlets bunched into fists that sparked at his fingertips.
"We will not find our father here. Only madness and death."
The Pyrai adept paced the bridge like an animal in heat, an alpha warrior, once in ascendance, but now emasculated.
"For once I find myself in agreement with you, Tolbeck,"
said Ignis, fingers drifting over the starboard surveyor array, as if seeking to impose order where none could ever exist.
"We will be walking blind into whatever snare this creature may have fashioned for us."
"You mortals," said Aphogomon,
"your lack of trust puts my kind to shame. I told you what they are. Gateways to where you need to go."
"That is what you say they are. But whether to believe that is another matter entirely," said Ahriman. "You are never born, so I am inclined to doubt every word you say."
"What reason have I to lie, Azek?" said Aphogomon.
"You need no reason, demon. It is your nature to deceive. I would be a fool to blindly follow you. If we are to set foot on these warp archipelagos, then I need to know what they are."
"All you need to know is that here is where you have to be, Ahriman,"
said Aphogomon.
"If you wish to save your father, this is the only way onwards."
"A route you happen to know about just as we seek it."
"Your own father bound me to this form and sent me to you, Azek,"
said Aphogomon, drawing its black, metalled fingers across the Invocata symbols graven on its torso. The squealing of metal on metal set Ahriman's teeth on edge.
"And didn't I tell you that you would fail without my help?"
"You also told me you were a scorpion upon my back."
The demon laughed.
Theatrics, Arzek, nothing more. My kind cannot help but indulge in them when dealing with mortals.
Why are we even listening to this thing? Snapped Hathormart, standing at the back of the bridge, looking like he wanted to be absolutely anywhere but there. His arms were folded, and his fingers tapped a restless tattoo against his forearms, as though he were communicating in code.
Perhaps your sire saw further than you, said Aphagomon. Perhaps he saw the means by which I would help save him, and maybe he saw that I knew this is where you need to be.
Tolbeck shook his head.
Led here by a demon on the back of an impossible vision, had by a mortal psychometric in the hopes that our father knew of it? A black day for the Thousand Sons.
Would that Menkaure was here, said Hathormart. He would know the truth of it.
Ahriman turned on Hathormart.
Hold your tongue,
he snapped, as the guilt of his old comrade's abandonment seared through him once more.
Menkaure did not command this expedition.
That burden fell to me.
Oh, and what a grand job you're doing, sneered Hathormart. Half our force dead and our greatest seer lost to the enemy, suffering who knows what monstrous tortures. That is, if the wolves haven't already killed him.
Hathormart stepped from the edge of the bridge, warming to his theme.
And what did we take from that orbiting asylum? What great prize did the mighty Ahriman deem worthy of such loss? A mortal seer whose vision makes no logical sense. No, Azek, I'll not hold my tongue when you allow this monster to bring us here, a place of lunacy that will see us all dead.
Ahriman reached inside for power, for the means to rip Hathormart apart from the inside. But all he felt were stirrings of minor cantrips. The glyph-scribed walls pulsed with powerful null geometries, and even those petty magics sank deep inside him once more. Perhaps the oppressive environment of the Osiris Panthea grated on Pavoni's sensibilities more than most, but Ahriman sensed more to Hathormart's tirade than simple frustration. Ahriman took a moment to compose himself in the face of the black ship's many provocations, the painful beehive static in his skull, the bitter taste of iron in his mouth, and the repercussive pain burning in his spine and joints.
You all saw what Mistress Shivani saw, he said. The burning of the Ysilti refinery fields, the library of Cadmus. There can be no other interpretation.
Sanact, you were inside her mind. You saw the truth of what she experienced when she held the chain attached to the Primarch's grimoire.
Sanact shrugged.
I saw what the Book of Magnus wanted her to see, Azek. That is all I can say with certainty. In any case, said Tolbeck, that library was destroyed before anyone could properly open it, you remember? The Primarch's fury, when he learned of its destruction, was a terrible thing. I remember it well, said Ahriman, stepping down to the open space before the shipmaster's throne.
He walked in a slow circle, punctuating his words with a clenched fist to the palm.
But I also remember what I saw in the Pyramid of Fotep. Library shelves, heavy with books of Phonicon Grammata, the alphabet brought to Boeotia by King Cadmus the Wanderer.
You forget two things,
said Hathormart, with the sneering tone of one who knows what he says will end a discussion.
First of all, what you believe she saw has already happened, and secondly, it happened on Terra. You would fly us right to the heart of the Emperor's realm on so flimsy a hope. Dawn's picket fleets would destroy us before we passed Neptune's moons.
Which is why I brought you here,
said Aphagomon, turning to face the shimmering, impossible islands of madness.
You still don't understand. You mortals and your oh-so-linear grasp of time. Surely the 15th, who once read the paths of the future, must know that space and time are one. That there is no such thing as past, present, or future. It is all the same dreaming moment, only viewed from differing aspects.
And these seven sleepers offer us a way back to where the Book of Magnus wants us to go, said Ahriman.
If you have sorrows enough to pay the price, said Aphagomon.
Trust me, said Ahriman. We have sorrows to spare.
The heat. Lemuel had forgotten the ferocious heat. A swollen sun beat down on the anvil of the desert sands like a molten hammer.
It shimmered from the ground in strength-sapping waves and bleached everything a hard shade of white. He'd expected the wolves to suffer, born as they were on a world of ice, but they endured the searing heat as though born to it, like the rad-cloaked Bedouin scav tribes who plundered the toxic sands of the Nord African Great Thirst. Surrounded by a hostile-looking cybernetic retinue, Promus stood with Nagasena, their heads craned upwards in disbelief. Behind them, a stormbird sat at the edge of this rocky ledge, its engines throbbing in a swirling cloud of salt dust. Their destination had been clearly visible from orbit, and Gearlothnir Hellblind had needed no avionics, no maps, and no guidance from Lemuel to find it.
"What was this? Do you know?"
asked Biaki, standing beside a pair of fallen megaliths at the entrance of a shadowed, uninviting valley. His fingertips followed the spiraling carvings cut into the base of one, but the rune priest knew better than to touch the wind-eroded stone.
"We called them dead stones," said Lemuel.
"Oh, good name," said Biaki.
"The natives believe them to be a barrier against an army of evil spirits entombed in the mountain," said Lemuel. "They said that this land had once been at the bottom of an ocean, and that this peak was only revealed when the immortal god slumbering beneath the sea shrugged and toppled the world."
Biaki shook his head in wonder.
"Maybe they were right,"
he said, wiping his hands on the plates of his armor.
"It's as good an explanation as any. So, Magnus and his sons went ahead and tore them down to see what would happen."
Promus turned and said, "This is the place."
"Are you serious?"
asked Lemuel.
"Answer the question."
Lemuel laughed and looked up at the mountain. Too vast and too monumental to have been raised by any natural means, mountain was too small a word for this soaring wonder.
"Yes, this is Agh Horu," said Lemuel,
looking up at the titan of mountains.
"This is where everything began falling apart.